Amen. Thank you, Joshua. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I had the opportunity to learn something about myself this morning. Maybe you did too, I don't know. But so I got up this morning and the house is empty. The girls are out of town for a couple of days. And so I only had to get myself ready and had an extra hour to do it. So I thought for sure I would have no trouble getting out the door at just the right time. But as usual, I was kind of rushing. And so I guess that's just my human nature coming through or something, I don't know. But good morning, it's good to see you. As we wrap up what we've been talking about, I just want to put this list of books in front of you in case you happen to have an interest in further study of evolution in particular. We're wrapping up several weeks of study. I told someone recently that I'm glad to be done talking about evolution because it gets boring pretty quickly, and it's not, I don't think it's worth as much, nearly as much time as it gets, or attention as it gets. But these books, if you are a young person, or if you are in a setting where the prevailing view is an evolutionary perspective and worldview, these books I have found very helpful, and you may as well. They're all written for non-specialists, people who are just interested in examining the facts and the theory itself from a critical perspective. I don't want to say too much about them. I will remark, as with any literature, you have to be careful. Not all of it is true. Just because it's in a book doesn't make it true. And so that certainly applies even to these books. And so you should be careful. Some of these authors, for example, believe in common descent, even though they reject natural selection and mutation as valid mechanisms, explanatory mechanisms. Others are much more clear in their thinking, I think. But for whatever that's worth, take these books with a grain of salt, but you may find them useful, as I have. And if you want to look at this list again, I'd be happy to give it to you. And if you'd like to borrow a copy of these books, I would be happy to loan them out. As we move forward now, coming back to our overall affirmation of Christianity, we're looking at things from a logical, rational perspective, and we want to accept only the conclusions that are warranted by the evidence. So we're building a case for the conclusion that you see there in number 4. You might say that Jesus is the Son of God is the objective of this argument, or the primary outcome of this, or conclusion of this argument. But that argument has several premises that have to be established before we get to the conclusion. And we want to do this in a way that is rational, reasonable, evidence-based, and so forth, so that we can conclude in a rational way that Jesus is the Son of God, or that anything that the Bible teaches is a true teaching, that it is in reality correct. The first premise there is that God exists, and we've looked at a couple of lines of evidence that support that premise, cosmological and teleological so far. Our study of evolution was an answer to the rebuttal of the naturalistic worldview to the teleological argument. So, but we want to move on now to the third and final line of evidence, line of reasoning for the first premise that God exists, namely the moral argument or the moral line of reasoning. Before we get to that argument, I want to just give us some biblical perspective on the idea of morality. Generally speaking, the word morality never appears in the Bible per se, which is interesting if you think about it. Now, there are words like morality that do appear. Even the word morals appears in some translations. For example, the American Standard Version of 1901, the New American Standard that came later, the English Standard Version, and several others use the word morals in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 33, where the text says that bad company, New American Standard, bad company, do not be deceived, bad company corrupts good morals. The word morals there is a translation of the word ethos from the Greek. which has to do with a pattern or habit of behavior, has to do with how you decide to behave, how you decide to conduct yourself. And so that translation then comes to us as morals. The New King James has, I believe, the word, I don't remember what the New King James is. The King James is manner. Bad company corrupts good manners. And words like this that reflect the idea of a way of behaving, a way of conducting oneself. Oftentimes in the New Testament and the Old Testament, we see the word immorality, which is obviously related, the negation of morality, but immorality, but often that's in the context of sexual immorality. And so it's condemned, and the idea there is that there is a way of behaving in the sexual realm that is wrong and should be avoided, and that's what's going on there with that word. The word moral comes to us directly from the Latin. There's a Latin word, moralis, that was used as far back as the first century BC. Based on things that I've looked at, it was used maybe by Cicero for the first time. And Cicero chose, according to one source, he chose to use the word moralis, the Latin word moralis, to translate the Greek word ethos. And so Cicero took ethos and translated it to Latin as moralis. And so it seems to be a reasonable translation, at least based on that information. But moralis is a principle, or denotes a principle, with which one judges rightness and wrongness. Rightness and wrongness. What principles are involved as we make judgments between things that are good or bad, or right or wrong? And that's the idea that's in view when we think about morality. Now, in the New Testament, the principles with which we judge right and wrong are always assumed to rely on God or to come from God directly. And I think this is reflected as well as anywhere in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 16. And Andy, I was imagining Andy being here today, so I could say, I'm almost maybe glad that he's not, because now I can say something positive about him without it looking like I'm trying to be too friendly. But Andy has taught in recent months some beautiful lessons, I believe, on 1 Peter chapter 1. And he's brought out very clearly this fact. In 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 16, the instruction is to be holy, for I am holy. And that's God's instruction to his people. Be holy, for I am holy. And what a commandment that is. And again, Andy has brought that out beautifully in more than one lesson in recent times. But what does it mean for God himself to instruct his creation to be holy, and not just without basis, without underlying principle to decide what that means, to be holy as I am holy, he says. Be holy as I am holy. You know, it's not uncommon in the New Testament for the standard of our behavior to be set at the level of the standard for which God, that God uses. You will recall in John 13 and verse 34, Jesus instructs his disciples to love as I have loved you. A new commandment I give you, that you love one another. And that love is to be as I have loved you, Jesus says, John 13, verse 34. In Ephesians 4 and verse 32, Paul instructs us to forgive as God in Christ has forgiven you. What a bar is set there. Holiness on the level of God's holiness. Love on the level of Christ's love. Forgiveness on the level of God's forgiveness of us. And so the bar, the standard of morality is incredibly high, in those contexts. Now, it's implicit in all of these passages that we've looked at and others we could see that God doesn't just make morals, he doesn't just pass them on to us, he is the underlying standard on which all of those morals are based. And we'll say more about that shortly. But God doesn't just tell us what to do and pass on or communicate these things to us. He himself is the inherent standard against which on which these morals are based. And that's an important thing for us to recognize. God is himself the standard of these things. Before we get to the argument, I want to make two quick points that are a little bit abstract, and then we'll move on. But two quick points about morality that I think are very important for us. First of all, the morality of an action or a behavior is not visible to the eye. It's not something that we can see by observation, that we can decide based on observation whether an action is moral or not. Now, to some extent, we can say things that are good and bad by observation. You'll know them by their works, Jesus said. And so to some extent, we can decide what actions are good and which are bad. But there's an element of morality that transcends what's visible, that is invisible, that we cannot observe directly. Turn with me, if you will, to 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 16. And I want to look in particular at verse 17, but we'll back up a bit to get some context. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 16, and I'll read down through verse 18. It says, "Therefore we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day." And here's verse 17. "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal." So back there in verse 17, Paul is talking about a working. This is New King James. He's talking about something that is working. Other translations say is producing, is generating. So the idea there is that there is a correspondence between the realm that we live in and the spiritual realm to which we are heading. And Paul says that the actions that we do, the behaviors that we do, the things that we endure in this life are working over on the other side some benefit. And he says that benefit is enormous. He says, by comparison, the benefit is weighty and exceedingly great. And what we deal with, the affliction that we deal with, is light. And it's momentary. We see there in verse 17. So there are behaviors that we're engaged in here, and those behaviors have a corresponding invisible component. There's something going on in the other realm that we do not observe directly, but something that is just as real as the afflictions that we go through ourselves. I knew someone one time who heard about a lady in a congregation whose lawnmower was not cutting the grass well because the blades were dull. And so this person volunteered to go over and look at the lawnmower and take the blades off and sharpen them and then put them back on so that the grass would be cut better by the lawnmower. And I was thinking about that, and I thought, is there anything visible in that process of taking a blade off of a lawnmower and sharpening it and putting it back on that you can identify as morally good? Is there anything you can see by watching this being done? Well, I don't think so. It involves taking off a bolt, removing, sharpen, put back on. There's nothing visible there that is morally good or morally bad for that matter. But there's no question that that action, if done with the right heart and so forth, is a morally good thing, a morally valuable thing to do. And so there's an invisible aspect to morality that we do not see it as it is. It exists in another realm. It's determined by standards that are invisible to us, though we see them by faith. If you turn forward a chapter in 2 Corinthians and look at chapter 6 and verse 17, we see this idea come out more explicitly, I think. Paul is reminding us of an Old Testament passage. I believe this is from the book of Isaiah. He says, "Come out," God is speaking, "come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you." And so God's desire for his people is to be moral, to be therefore separate, and to follow him, even if the value of those actions, the value of such behavior, is not obvious or visible to the senses. So that's the first first point. Morality of an action is not always visible. Secondly, though, as we think about morality, it's important for us to recognize the relationship between goodness and God. What's the relationship between goodness and God? This is a common discussion among philosophers, whether God is good because good is good, or good is good because God says it's good. And let me try to illustrate what's going on there. There are two options, they say, the philosopher says. And by the way, when somebody says there are two options, you might be suspicious from the beginning as to whether or not they're right about that. How do you know there are two options? But the philosopher says there are two options pertaining to the relationship between God and what is good. On the one hand, they say, maybe it's the case that God is kind of supreme in the relationship. He is greater than goodness in some sense. And God then declares to people what is good. So God is above goodness, and then he decides in a way that's contingent. In other words, he could have said that other behaviors are good than the ones he happened to choose, say in the Bible. God is up here. He decides then to declare a certain, based on some choice that he made, that he could have made otherwise, what is good. And so in that sense, God is determining what is good. It's not good inherently, they would say, in that scenario. God is deciding what is good, and he could have chosen something different to be good. In the second place, the second option, they say, is that the picture is upside down. Here, good is at the top, good is supreme. God is then subject to the goodness, and he has to behave in a way that is good. It's external to himself, but he has to look to it and decide to behave in a way that's consistent with what is good. On the one hand, God is at the top, and he decides what is good based on some level of arbitrariness. On the other hand, God is subject to goodness. It's external to him, and he has to behave the way he does in order to keep himself in the good, you might say. These are the two options that are put forward. Was there a comment in the back? Yes, sir. Yes.
Something clicked in my mind. You remember back in the Old Testament where the man was allowed to marry more than one or have more than one wife as long as he could take care of it. Hmm. Then in the New Testament, we're taught that we're only allowed to have one wife. So that would that be a variance in his goodness and judgment there?
Well, it could be. But I would say it's in the Old Testament, God's desire was never for man to have more than one wife. That was never his desire. And we know that because he says, you might draw that conclusion on the basis of something in Matthew chapter 19, where Jesus says, because of the hardness of your heart, Moses permitted certain things. And so there was a certain amount of permission. Acts chapter 17 calls that overlooking times of ignorance. In the Old Testament, whereas now God's standard has been revealed to a greater degree, you might say, and God is now holding us to the fullness of his standard, you might say, something like that. Is that reasonable? Yeah. Okay, thank you. So this idea of God being greater than good or good being greater than God is not is purported to be the two options available to us. So what do we say about that? Is God greater than good, in which case he decides what is good, and good could therefore be different than it is, or is good greater than God, and God therefore is subject to something external to himself? The problem with both of these positions is that they both separate God from goodness. And you might ask, why is it valid to separate God from goodness? Why isn't it possible that God is the definition of good, and that good involves inherently who God is? In other words, they cannot be separated. In other words, good could not be different from what it is, because it's inherent in the nature of God. The fundamental error here, I think, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this point, but the fundamental error, I think, in this point, in this dichotomy, is the same as the error that the Greeks made in the way they constructed their gods, namely, that they constructed their gods to be like themselves. The gods of the Greeks were burdened from top to bottom with man-like shortcomings, man-like weaknesses. And I think the same thing is going on here when we're assuming that we understand the nature of God in a way that could make us capable of making so fine a distinction between goodness and God. We are thinking of God as limited and finite, like ourselves, and not as he is, that is perfect in all of his attributes, and so forth. And so the nature of goodness and God is something that we want to keep clear. That is that God is inherently good, and that good inherently comes from God, that is the two are bound together. Coming then to the moral argument itself. So we want to make an argument that we can defend and think about and substantiate that draws a conclusion that supports the premise that God exists. And here is one such argument that we can turn to. The moral argument, or one form of it, goes in this way. In the first place, if God does not exist, then there are no objective moral values and duties. And each of those words is important and needs to be understood carefully. But for the time being, let's just get through the argument. If God doesn't exist, there are no objective moral values and duties. Number two, there are objective moral values and duties. Now, again, that's something you have to support and something that you have to evidence. But if those first two things are true, then it necessarily logically follows that God exists. If he doesn't exist, there are no objective morals and values. There are objective morals and values, moral values and duties. Therefore, he must exist. So that's a logically valid argument. It's logically valid. That is, if the two premises are true, the conclusion has to follow from them. Now, as we go through our thinking about these premises during our time today, I want to point out that the first premise can be rewritten in a way that's entirely logically equivalent to the way it's written in number one at the top. That is, if there are objective moral values and duties, then God does exist. Those two things, those two statements, those two if-then statements are entirely logically equivalent. The one is called the contrapositive of the other, and they are equivalent to one another. So if God does not exist, there are no moral values and duties, objectively. And that's equivalent to, if there are more objective moral values and duties, then God does exist. One takes a negative view and lets us view the hypothesis negatively, that is, if God does not exist, then something. And the other one says, in the positive, if there are these objective morals and moral values and duties, then the positive conclusion as well is true as well, which would be that God does exist. Okay? The two are switched, so the antecedent and consequent of that implication are switched, and they are both negated. And when you do that, you get something that is logically equivalent as you go forward. This argument is made by William Lane Craig. You may have heard of him. He's a philosopher, a theistic philosopher, but the argument exists in many forms and has been made for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Okay, so as we examine this argument and go through it, I want to start with the second premise that's listed. So the second premise being, in the original statement, there are objective moral values and duties. There are objective moral values and duties. And I want to start with this premise because it lets us define the terms that we're using. All the interesting terms are in this second premise. So let's start quickly with some terminology. In the first place, we need to draw a distinction between objective and subjective realities and values. Objective versus subjective, what is the difference? Well, these terms apply to not just moral values, not just moral duties, but lots of things in our everyday experience. And the way to remember the meaning of these two terms, I think, is in the words themselves. Subjective things, subjective valuations of things, depend on the subject or the individual who is interacting with whatever the object, whatever the thing is. For example, tacos. While my wife and daughter are out of town, I will make them because I can't when they're home. They don't like them. Okay, so their valuation, Angela's and Ava's, is negative. Mine is positive, so it depends on the subject. There's nothing inherently, objectively, good or bad or valuable or invaluable about a particular food or dessert or anything like that. It depends on the individual. There's no basis on which I could say you ought to or should like tacos or not like tacos. That's purely subjective. The value of a piece of art or literature or furniture may to you be very great, and you may very much appreciate it, whereas to another subject or individual, that object is not so valuable, or at least less valuable, or maybe negatively valuable. Okay, so we can imagine that these things depend on the individual. Sentimental value is almost always subjective. That is, it depends on the individual. There are certain vacation places, for example, that you have visited that hold a sentimental value to you, and that value does not pass on from person to person. It's particular to you, the subject. These ideas apply, of course, much more importantly in the realm of morality. And since we're making the argument that morality is objectively determined, we will look at some objective matters on which we would hold opinions that these things are objective. So in the first place, equality or fair treatment for all people. Is that an objective or subjective valuation? Is it morally valuable to pursue equality and fair treatment, or is it just a matter of my opinion, or just a matter of the opinion of the majority of the individuals in a particular nation or country? Or would it be wrong to not treat all persons equally and fairly, even if everyone thought that so doing was perfectly fine? What if all of us decided that it's okay to be unfair in our treatment? Would that then make it okay to be unfair in our treatment of individuals? Or is there something about equality inherently and fair treatment inherently that transcends whatever I think about it or whatever you think about it? What about protection of unborn children? So this is a dramatic example where we would ask the question, is it objectively wrong or subjectively, only subjectively wrong, to harm an unborn child? Or domestic violence. Is it objectively wrong or only subjectively wrong? So that another person could say it's okay or okay in some circumstances or something like that. What about political violence? Something like treatment, harsh treatment, violent treatment of subjects by a government. Is that wrong? Is it objectively wrong or only subjectively wrong? So these are the sorts of things we're thinking about when we study objective versus subjective realities. But let's move on to the rest of the terminology and come now to value and duty. What's the difference between value and duty? There is a difference, I'm convinced, and I'm interested to see what you think about it. So let's start with values. What are moral values? Well, the valuation of a thing is a decision as to whether it is in and of itself good or bad? Is something morally good or morally bad? Moral values cannot be measured in dollars. What's the moral value of, for example, an ounce of gold, or the moral value of the clothing that you're wearing, or the moral value of something like this? These objects have no moral value. You can't value them in dollars. But they measure the goodness or badness of an action. And again, this is where we come back to that idea of the invisibility of the morality. It's not a physical matter. There's something transcendent about it that we must answer by an appeal to a higher plane. We can't answer it based on physical considerations. So moral values are values that we placed on the goodness or badness of an action. In contrast, moral duties and obligations have to do with individuals. That is, should I, in the set of circumstances I find myself in right now, do this particular action? Ought I to do it, or ought I not to do it? Would it for me right now be right or wrong to do X? And that relates to personal, individual duty and obligation. So there's a matter of valuing things as good or bad, but then there's a separate issue of deciding for me, in my particular situation, what is my duty? Would it be right for me to do X, or wrong for me to do X? And the main distinction here, I think, is that not all morally valuable things are obligatory for a particular person. For example, it would be a morally valuable thing for me to, or you to, work hard in my job of saving the lives of people as a doctor. Okay, but I'm not a doctor, and I'm under no obligation to become a doctor and try to heal people or to work hard at a job as a physician. That's not an obligatory thing for me to do, even though it is a morally valuable thing to do. We would all agree. So there's a difference between a value and a duty. The one has to do with inherent values of actions. The other has to do with my personal responsibility or obligation. So that brings us to the second premise again. So we go back to premise two. We have some terminology. We understand the difference between objective and subjective matters, and the difference between values and duties. So the question then is, looking back at premise two, which is here, can you evidence that there are objective moral values and duties? Are there objective moral values? First of all, do they exist? The claim that we're making in premise two is that there are actions or ideals or behaviors or words even that we could say which are objectively good or bad. That's the claim, that there are some. So it's a claim of existence. There are ideals and actions which are objectively good and bad. Now, for the sake of this argument, we don't have to specify which ones they are. That is, we don't have to say a particular action is morally good or bad. We're just asking the question of existence, which is, are there objectively good and objectively bad actions? Are there any at all? Are there any matters about which we can objectively say they are good or bad? The truth of this claim, I think, can perhaps be best established by looking at what it would mean for the claim to be false. That is, what would it look like if there are no actions or ideals which are objectively good or bad? What would that look like? To say there are no actions or ideals which are objectively good or bad is to say that every action or ideal cannot be called in an objective way good or bad. That is, every action you can imagine, every good or bad actions that you can imagine or that you've ever heard about or read about in the news or examined from any perspective, every single action cannot objectively be called good or bad. If there's even a single exception, we've satisfied our premise, our second premise, that there are objectively good actions and objectively bad actions. So we would have to be able to claim that there are none, and what that would look like is that every single action we encounter is not objectively good or bad. And this would range from personal matters, where we're thinking about our own well-being and ways maybe that we could be negatively affected by someone doing some harm to us, all the way up to the national level, where we would think about something like the situation in the world during World War II with the Holocaust and so forth. All of these things, if there are no objectively good and bad matters, good and bad moral values, all of these things would be morally neutral, that, or at least morally subjective. That is, I couldn't say, without reference to myself, that these things are good or bad. They may be good or bad to me, but I couldn't expect you to feel the same way about that. An interesting point here is that I believe, and that doesn't make it true, but I believe this argument that we're looking at right now has a lot more punch for a lot of people than the arguments we've looked at previously, the cosmological and teleological argument. There is a part of me that prefers to make the cosmological and teleological arguments when we're thinking about the existence of God. But I think on an emotional level, on a realistic level where people are engaged in their own experiences and we're engaged in our own valuations of things, you will find almost no one who's willing to deny that there are some actions. Now, that'll vary from person to person, but there are some actions that are objectively good or bad, right or wrong. And so that's the moral value side of things. So let's move on then and apply this same thing to moral duties. What about me individually? Are there things that I should be doing or should not be doing? Or is it just a matter of my own opinion? Is it subjective, depends on me? And is what you do a matter of your own opinion, so that I couldn't ever expect you to behave in any certain way or say that anything you do or have done is wrong? The claim is there are some actions and ideals that are correctly judged as right and wrong. And we're talking about at the personal level now. Some things are objectively right or wrong, and that transcends individuals. Again, think about this from the negative perspective. The negation of there are some is that there are not some. In other words, there are none. There are none. And to say that there are none of a certain category is the same as saying that every single one of them in the category, every single action or ideal, cannot be objectively judged as right or wrong. And again, this would apply, if it were true, it's a universal, every single action or ideal, it would apply from the smallest actions that I could do or not do to the greatest actions that I could do or not do. The committing of my life to some purpose or some goal or some aim, all the way down to what I do on a daily basis. If every single action cannot be objectively judged as right or wrong, then what would that look like? Is anyone willing to make that claim? Now, there are people who make that claim. There are individuals who believe that at the end, all there is blind, pitiable indifference and subjectivity, and any moral constructions that we've produced are figments of our imagination or this sort of thing. And some people hold that position. But is that a reasonable position based on our experience? Is it more reasonable to conclude that some actions are objectively right and wrong for me to perform, and some actions or ideals are objectively morally valuable versus not morally valuable? Which is more reasonable and more likely to be true? Any questions or comments before we move on? Questions, thoughts?
Are you saying that cannot be objectively judged right or wrong. There is no middle ground where the action is neither right or wrong.
No, I'm not saying there is no middle ground. There are certainly, certainly not. So there are, of course, some actions which are, I would say, morally neutral, so far as you can tell. But the claim is that there is at least one, basically. There's at least one action. That's really a very modest claim, that there's at least one action which is objectively good or bad. Okay, very good. Other questions or comments, thoughts? Okay, so in that case, if we conclude that either of these claims are true, certainly if we conclude that both of the claims are true, then that requires some sort of a standard. The argument would proceed. So if there are objective values, that is, values that transcend me as an individual, that absolutely demands that there be some standard that's bigger than me. Some standard that transcends me, transcends not only me, but all of us as a group, transcends all of us as a county and as a state and as a nation and even as a world. Some standard that transcends and goes beyond any personal opinion. And we'll have to pick up there next week with our first premise. Thank you for your attention.